Another great year at SES conference. Amazing, isn't it? Now, what we're going to talk about this morning is we're going to kind of look at a case, the case for God's existence, but I'm going to take you on a kind of different route. And some of you are familiar with my work and some of you aren't. So for some of you, you're probably going to be scratching your head and thinking to yourself, really? What in the world are you talking about? This is kind of a strange way of looking at this. Because my background is such that it's kind of prompted me to take a strange angle at this. I've been working in Los Angeles County for the last 25 to 30 years now. Hate to say that, but working cold cases. These are just unsolved murders. And so there's no statute of limitations on a murder. So we can go back and open those up years later and work these as though they're fresh. So my cases are usually in that range of about 1979 to about 1988. Of course, we do have new cold cases that are in the 2000s. Doesn't that seem crazy? I used to think that in 2015, I realize now there are cold cases that are dated in 2000. I feel really old when I say that, right? So when I first started, some of these cases were the cases my dad had opened back in the 70s. And so I was working those cases, and I had a chance to kind of open his old cases to see if I could solve it, just so I could make fun of him, right? But I never actually was able to solve any of his cases. Now, my son is there doing the same work that I have been doing for years, and he is wearing the same uniform that I wore before him. We're going to flip back and forth. Pay no attention to the flipping back and forth. I'm not sure why that's doing that. And he's wearing the same uniform, using the same tools I used. He even has the same name because we take the same name and we use it over and over and over again until you're sick of it, okay? So I've got his name, but a different middle name. My middle name is Warner. My dad's middle name and Jimmy's middle name is David. And he is basically taking the same approach that I took, that my dad took before me. And he has the same name. His name is also Jim Wallace. It's going to drive me crazy. Give me a second to talk awkwardly amongst yourselves. We always say that, Greg and I. If we're having media problems, and I'll fix these while we're talking. How's that sound? See if I can get this to stop doing that. When you travel, I'm going to get you behind the scenes. When you travel, you have one of these. This is every possible doodad and gadget and thing you can use to solve these kinds of problems. So let's see. And the best way to go through these to figure out what you have is to do this. You ready? This is technical. There you go. So give me a second here as I figure out how to solve this problem. And if that doesn't work, have no fear. I have another bag. Hang on a minute. Same technical process. Here we go. Oh, this one might solve it. This one might solve it. Let's see. Yes, this might work. So you have to go from there to this. And then from that to this. You didn't come here to hear I do PowerPoint, did you? I don't think you did. We'll find out here. Okay, here we go. Let's see if it works. We'll see. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Okay. Hey, so far, maybe it did work. Nobody move, okay? Everyone inhale, but no exhaling until we're done. Okay. So my dad has the same name as me, and we just use these names over and over again. So I'm a James Warner. He's a James David. He's a James David. I have a David Warner. Yeah, believe it or not, that's my other son. Anyway, the point is, we've been doing this now for 56 years at the same agency. And that has allowed us to learn some things that I'm going to try to transfer to you today. And now most of the stuff I'm talking about, I write about at a website called coldcasechristianity.com. We have a phone app, so you can download all that stuff. Everything we're talking about today, we're going to cover a small piece of this talk today, but you can download all of it and watch it from your phone. And you can reach out to me on social media also. But I also want to just tell you, this is a shameless plug. I also serve at Colson Center as a senior fellow there, and this is a great place to go to kind of learn to make the case on your own through our fellows, Colson Fellows program. So hopefully if you get a chance to do that, and it's easy to find, that's at colsonfellows.org. Now, that being said, about a year ago, I was asked to do a six-minute scene in God's Not Dead 2. And in this scene, I had 6 minutes to communicate the case for Christianity. That's not a lot of time, right? And I think if you were asked, well, what 6 minutes would you share with your friends or your family members? It might be a challenge to figure out what 6 minutes you should share. And so what we're going to talk about really is going to be a shortened version of this book I've written called God's Crime Scene. And I'm going to start by teaching you how to work death scenes. We're going to do a little death scene 101, okay? Because not every death scene is a crime scene. There are four ways to die. So we'll start off with the dead guy in the room who looks suspiciously like my son Jimmy. Back when he used to work at Trader Joe's. Before he became a police officer. So here he is dead. All we have so far is a dead guy laying face down in the room. So we got to figure out, is this a crime? Or is this just a dead guy? Not every dead guy is murdered. So what we do is make two lists that begin with an E. A list of evidences and a list of explanations. Now so far all we have for evidence is there a dead guy laying face down. Now there are four ways to explain dead guys laying face down. Natural deaths, accidental deaths, suicides, and murders. These are the four ways that people die. My question when I get into a scene like this is, how do we know which of these four is the most reasonable explanation for what we have so far? Well, can I cross out anything here? Are any of these so unreasonable that I can just cross them out? You can actually answer for me. Which one? Not really any of them, right? Because if he dies of a heart attack, he's going to look like that. That would be a natural. If he accidentally took too many pills, he would look like that. If he intentionally took too many pills, he would look like that. If I poisoned him with too many pills, he would look like that. So I really can't cross out anything. Let's change our scenario. What if he is a dead guy laying face down, but now he's in a pool of his own blood, center torso? Would that change things? Let's add that additional piece of evidence. Remember, we're making two lists, a list of evidences, a list of explanations. So we can add that to our list. And now, can I cross out anything? Yeah, now it's not around his head. So if he had like a brain aneurysm, hits the deck, and he bleeds out through his nose, it wouldn't look like this. This is around center torso. Where could I naturally bleed from center torso? That's tough, right? So I can cross that out. Can I cross out anything else? I gotta kind of roll him over, don't I? And see what that injury is to see what it is before I can cross that. So let's change the scenario. What if he's a dead guy and he's laying face down in a pool of his own blood, but he's got a single gunshot wound and it's an exit wound coming out of his back? Let's go back and add that to our list. We now have a single exit wound in his back and the gun laying by his side. What can I cross out, guys? Accidental. Well, if he was accidentally handling a gun he thought was unloaded, and it was loaded, it shot himself, it would be an exit wound coming out of his back. So see, we're even stuck with this, right? Can't really cross out anything. Let me change the scenario. What if lying next to his side, there is a note? And that note is written on his own stationery, I find elsewhere in the room. It's in his own handwriting. And it's a suicide note. Would that change things? I think so. Let's put that on our list. We're going to add this to our list now. Can I cross out anything? Yeah, he might have accidentally killed himself prior to his intention to kill himself, but he clearly looks like he wanted to kill himself. So we can cross out that one. Are you guys convinced it's suicide now? There's a suicide note. It could be it's in his handwriting. Only his fingerprints are on that note. Somebody forced him to write the suicide note. See, this is what happens when a culture has been exposed to criminal minds. Because that show is so stupid that you all think that there's somebody there forcing him to write this. It's so casual, but that's okay. He forced him somehow to write whatever. That's criminal mind stuff, okay? Okay, what if I change the scenario? What if he's not got a single gunshot wound, but he's got multiple gunshot wounds? Hey, what if those gunshot wounds were all entry wounds, not exit wounds? What if the note does not have his fingerprints on it, and I can't find that paper or pen anywhere else in the house? It's foreign. It's got foreign fingerprints, foreign DNA, skin cell transfer on that note. What if there were bloody footprints leading out of the room? That would change your mind, right? So let's put those in there. There we go. You can tell this is a California murder right here, right? Only in California is there barefoot killers. That's clearly the beach out there, so you can tell he's going surfing. So let's add all these things to our case. Now, if I add these to my list, I think the most reasonable inference is no longer suicide, right? It's clearly a homicide. How do we get there? Well, this process we just used is a process called abductive reasoning. But they did something else here you may not have noticed. It's a little trick that I started teaching homicide investigators. If you can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, it's not going to be a murder. Do you hear what I just said? If you can explain everything you find in the room by staying inside the room for an explanation, it's not going to be a murder. In other words, let's just make it clear. Let's just reduce this down to the room being a box, let's say. And we'll play this little game of inside or outside the box. Again, if I can explain everything in the box by staying in the box. So if that, for example, is his handwriting, his fingerprints, on stationery I find elsewhere in the room, well, I can actually explain that. He could have done that by himself without any help from anyone else outside the room. I can explain that by staying in the room. And if that's his gun and people say, well, yeah, he loves that gun. He's had it for his whole, you know, years and years and years. He keeps it in a safe in the corner of the room. Now I can even explain the gun by staying inside the room for a cause. And anyone can shoot themselves once without any help from anybody else. All of these things that can now be explained by just staying inside the room. And if that's the case, it's going to be one of these three. It's not going to be a natural, clearly, but it's going to be one of those two. On the other hand, if the best explanation for the stuff in the room is a cause outside the room, I've got to change everything. So if I said, well, you know, look, that's not his stationery. That's not his handwriting. There's unknown fingerprints. No one lives there, has those fingerprints. Now I've got to go outside the room for a cause for that note. And he might say, well, he's afraid of guns. He's never owned a gun. And sure enough, it's not registered to him. And doesn't have any forensic evidence that ties it to him. So now I got to find whose gun is that. And it's hard to shoot yourself multiple times in the back. Right? And I've got bloody footprints that are leading out of the room. So clearly the best cause is something outside the room. Now, if this is the case where the best explanation for the stuff that's in the room is a cause outside the room, everything shifts. Why? Because I've just got evidence of an intruder. And intruders change everything. In fact, intruders are what turn death scenes into crime scenes. Intruders are what ought to take that sense of curiosity you have about why somebody would kill themselves or how they could die accidentally, and it ought to take that sense of curiosity and turn it into a sense of urgency. Because the one show on TV that gets what we do best is a simple show called The First 48. Have you ever seen that? It's boring, right? It's just a camera over someone's shoulder while they're solving a homicide. And there's no crazy stuff going on, right? Because it's not Criminal Minds, all right? Now, I started thinking, as a guy who was not a Christian, looking at this as a very committed philosophical naturalist. In other words, I thought that everything in the universe could be explained through some set of natural causes, natural forces. I thought that everything we could get, you could get with space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. That's all you need to explain anything in our environment, anything in our natural experience. So we could take this approach, couldn't we, and turn it toward the universe. What if the room we're looking at is not a death scene, but is instead the entire natural universe? Again, couldn't we play a little game of inside or outside the room? Can I explain all the evidence that's in that room by staying in the room? There's eight things we've got to explain. We've got to explain how the universe comes into existence from nothing. What I mean is nothing. All space, time, matter did not exist before the beginning of the universe. That's not my claim. That's the claim of science. But that means whatever causes this cannot be spatial, material, or temporal. So already we're looking for a cause outside of space, time, and matter, outside of what we consider to be natural causes. Because what is nature? It's space, time, matter, and the laws that impact space, time, and matter, right? If we're outside of those, we're outside of what we would call nature. So we're looking for an extra natural first cause from the get-go. But then we've got to describe why the universe is fine-tuned for the existence of life. That those fine, narrow cosmological constants, weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, so narrowly focused that the smallest variation produces a universe that either can't sustain itself or certainly can't sustain life. That's actually pretty non-controversial amongst many scientists who are not believers. That we have to explain this fine-tuning. And we have the origin of life from non-life. And the life that does emerge appears to be designed. Even Dawkins says that the entire discipline of biology is seeking answers for what appears to have been designed for a purpose. So that's not even all that controversial. Then we have to think about this using what? Our brains or our minds? Do we have minds or we just have brains? If we have brains, I can understand how you might get physical things, brains, from physical processes in a physical universe. But if we have minds, those are non-material. How do we get... This is why philosophers call this the problem of mind. How do we explain minds that can actually act freely? Physical things like dominoes just fall when they're fallen against. If we're just dominoes and all of our thoughts are simply neurons that are firing on the basis of prior neurons that are firing, as Sam Harris, the atheist, who's a neuroscientist, and he's also a philosopher of sorts, he would say that you don't control those neurons that fire. So you don't have the free will or free agency you think you have under atheism. But we think we have free agency. How do we explain that? Can we explain that with just physics? And we have objective, transcendent moral truths, and we have this problem we're going to talk about today. Because I could go through all eight of these. This is a class I teach that takes 17 hours. So if you wanted evidence that God exists, I could hold you in this classroom for the next 17 hours and talk about this stuff. But I will not do that. Therefore, God exists. For most of you, you're thinking, good. There must be a God because he spared me all that. Okay, the point is, if I can explain these things by staying inside the room, then some causal forces of evolution on space-time and matter, physics and chemistry, can get all this done. Now, on the other hand, if you can't stay inside the room for an answer, if the best answers are outside the room of naturalism, well, then you've got a problem because you've got evidence of an intruder. And this is why I called this God's crime scene. My publisher did not want to use this name. They came back to me again and again, changed the name of the book. It sounds like you're saying God is committing a crime. No, I'm not saying God's committing a crime. I'm saying you could actually investigate the universe like a crime scene to discover what the first cause is. Now, we're going to take that same approach, right? We have a list of evidence in the room, a list of explanations that are possible. Well, in this case, we have eight evidences in the room of the universe, and we have only a couple of ways of explaining those eight pieces of evidence. Here are the eight pieces that we just talked about, and we have two possible explanations for those eight pieces. Either we stay inside the room for natural, unguided forces using nothing more than space, time, and matter, or we jump outside of those causes and we look for something that's extra natural, something outside the room. And I'm going to jump all the way to the bottom of this list for this talk. We're just going to talk about what some people would say is an evidence against God. And it's the problem of evil. I think it's an evidence we have to... Everyone's got to account for this. As an atheist, I would have said, this to me is best accountable by the random nature of the universe, which is just guided by physics. That's why we have bad things that happen. You know, and instead of... You can roll one, or you can roll two, you can roll seven, you can roll all kinds of things with a dice. It's not a, if you decide something's bad, then you might roll it. So we have to explain this problem of evil. There's been lots of folks who have said this is actually a good evidence against God. Well, if there's one thing that homicide detectives talk about a lot, it's evil. This is my dad. I love to show this picture because he's not a Christian. He's an atheist. But he thinks he looks stupid in that picture, and I kind of agree. First of all, he's got this ridiculous mustache. By the way, real quickly, on an aside, no one in 2017 wears just a mustache, okay? That's over, all right? It is. Everyone has either no facial hair or a beard or a goatee, am I right? So, for example, right now, if you're somebody who's in this room who has just a mustache, please raise your hand. Raise your hand. Just a mustache. There you go. Old guy. See? He just proved my point. Dude, shave that off today, okay? I got a razor in my bag. You can do it at the break, okay? So he hates that part. He also thinks his butt looks big sticking out right here. But that's actually his gun. You just can't tell because he's right-handed, so I can't tell what that is. But this guy here was accused of killing a 10-year-old in our city. It was a horrific crime. I remember when I was first opening this case, I reopened it. I remember asking the family for some help. And, of course, the family doesn't care about... Really, the family has a pressing question that it wants answered that's even probably, in some ways, more important than who did it. It's, why would this kind of thing ever happen to our daughter? I'll use the name Jackie. It's still an open case, so I'm not going to use her real name. But I always say that any act of evil has to be explained cumulatively on the basis of several key things that come together at the same time. My job is to unpuzzle it. In other words... Jackie was the kind of girl who would get in someone's car, even a stranger's car. This is why we tell you guys, if you're youngsters in here, don't get in strangers' cars. But she was the kind of kid who would do that. This is 1972. And so she got into a stranger's car. If she's not the kind of kid who gets into a stranger's car, this crime does not occur. Also, it was a very busy holiday. On the day of the holiday, her family said, get out of the house. All you kids get out of the house. We're trying to make dinner. Don't come back in the house until we call you back in the house and dinner is ready. So they're not paying attention to what Jackie's doing. If it's not a busy holiday and she's not the kind of kid who gets into a car, this crime does not occur. Also, if you've ever worked these kinds of cases, you know that the person who assaulted her, the person who did this to her, probably has a disturbing upbringing of his own. Most of the pedophiles that I've worked have themselves been victims as kids. If he isn't the kind of person who's been a victim himself, it's not a busy holiday, and she doesn't get in the car, this doesn't happen. Do you see what's going on here? All of these stars have to be aligned. Also, this guy had access and knew how to get into this weird little niche pocket of our city. It's not a place you would know even exists unless... So he's probably somebody who happens to know and be able to navigate our city. If he doesn't know that neighborhood, doesn't have that background, it's not a busy holiday and she doesn't trust him, this doesn't happen. And he had to have the right car. And he had to have the opportunistic timing. We didn't find her body till the next day. Now, why do I say this? Because anytime someone asks me to explain a particular act of evil, I know there's not an easy answer. It's a complicated answer. And it's more complicated than this because these things have unique relationships to one another. Maybe he knows the neighbor because he actually lived there at some point. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe it's something else. I got to figure out all the connectivity between all the stars that have aligned. Make sense? This is why it's so hard to solve these kinds of things. So if you ask me how to explain the problem of evil, I am not going to give you trite, quick answers because they're not trite or quick. All of these things contribute to any particular act of evil. Now, I say all of this because when I typically talk about the case for God's existence, it's also complicated. It's cumulative. These things, I think, point toward the existence of God. All that stuff I showed you, I think, points toward the existence of God. And when anything points toward a suspect, we call that kind of evidence inculpating evidence. But now we have this additional piece of evidence, the problem of evil. Well, you know, you can have a lot of good reasons to believe your guy is the guy, your suspect's the suspect, but then he could tell you he was in Germany on the day of the murder. So now his alibi excludes him. And when you have evidence that points away from him or that points to somebody else who's a better candidate, that kind of evidence is called exculpating evidence. Inculpating? Is this exculpating? Is the problem of evil actually an evidence that destroys God as my primary suspect, that eliminates him as a cause? Some people would say so. As a matter of fact, the most classic formation of this objection is from Epicurus. Look how ancient this objection is. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then why? He's not omnipotent. If he's able but not willing, then he's malevolent. If he's both able and willing, then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? I'll give it to you in English. If there is a God who's all-powerful, then why can't he stop this nonsense? Stop calling him all-powerful then if he can't stop it. Is there a God who's all-powerful but not willing? Well, then he can't call him all-loving. If he was loving, he'd be willing to stop it. If he's not able to or willing to stop it, why are we calling this thing God? Maybe there's good evidence that he's not, that doesn't exist. Because if there was an all-powerful, all-loving God, he would not allow that to happen. That is the objection. Well, how do I answer that? It's not going to be a quick answer. Like Jackie. It's a number of things that I think contribute to an answer, and we have to understand how they connect. I think it's an issue of eternity. I think it's an issue of really defining the role of free agency and the definition of love and how it is that God might use any event to develop character or draw people, or how it is, for example, that there's a balance between justice and mercy and the character of God, or even our limited understanding. Now, I'm going to blow through these really fast. Hold on. You ready? We're going to drink out of a fire hose. Let me show you how this works. Because I think this metric is exactly how I explain evil to anybody. And this is why I don't do it on Twitter. And I can't do it in 140 characters. This takes a little more time. The first thing I think is really having a proper definition of the role of eternity. These are what contribute. So let's talk about eternity for a second. This changed the way I thought about everything. Because as an atheist, I would have told you I had a problem with evil. Why? Because my definition of life, a good life lived, was that period of time between birth and death. I wanted about 90 years. 90 pain-free, enjoyable years. That was my goal. I got grandparents who are living in their 90s, so I thought, hey, I can do 90. And by the way, anything that would prevent me from getting 90 pain-free years, I would have called evil. So if I'd have gotten, say, cancer at the age of 40 and suffered for 10 years and died at the age of 50, I would have seen that as evil. Why? Because I expected to get this part and now I'm not getting it. And that was painful. Life stinks. There can't be a God because no one should live like that. No one should have that experience. Really? Well, it might just be that your definition of life is the problem. And as an atheist, that was exactly the problem. In other words, what if life is not a line segment, but is instead a ray that begins at birth, extends through this point we call death, and it goes off into this direction forever? Would that change the problem of evil? I think it might. There are people in this room right now who suffered, were born with some abnormality, and you had to have an operation in the first year of life, the first 2 days of life. You had some significant operation, some significant surgery. And if I was to stop time right there and say, hey, how's life treating you so far? You'd have said, it stinks. It's terrible. It's painful. What's the point of even being here? But by the time you were like 5 years old, you didn't even know you had a surgery. Because it turns out all of these experiences of evil are always measured in the context of your life. And by this point in your life, you were over it. And certainly by this point, you have no memory at all of that evil you suffered back here. All evil must be measured in the context of our foundational definition of what life is. And for me, it was all about the life segment, line segment. But this is the part that I was ignoring. Just think about that for a second. If this is the definition of life and it goes off in eternity, every year on the other side of the grave, you're 1,000 years into eternity, you're 2,000 years into eternity, the longer that goes, the shorter your temporal life is by comparison. Until finally your temporal life is a millisecond compared to the life you have in eternity with God, of which there is no pain, no suffering. So again, you can say, I had the worst 90 years. Okay, I get it. But you have to measure your experience in light of what your definition of life is, and now you're measuring it in terms of eternal life. Do you see the difference eternity makes? A lot of us as Christians live and experience and complain about problems as though the atheist worldview is true. And we only have 90 years to make it right. We have a lot more. Eternity does change everything. But so does this definition or this role that free agency plays. Look, you hear it said all the time. Okay, if there's an all-loving God who's all-powerful, what kind of world would he create? Would he create a world in which love is possible or a world in which love is impossible? If those are your two choices, a world in which love is possible or impossible, which do you think that God's going to create? He's going to create the top one, right? Are you sure you want that? That's a very dangerous world. You want a world in which love is possible? My wife's sitting in the back row over here. We got married on Valentine's Day many years ago. And if I split up with her and we got in a fight and I decided I wanted to win her back, so I wait till Valentine's Day of next year to win her back and I send her this card in my effort to win her back. Here's the card I'm going to send her. You will love me. Roses are red. Bullets are lead. Take me back now or get shot in the head. You know she's going to come back, right? And if I said to her, do you love me? She's going to say, I love you. Yeah, would it be real love? No, this is a stupid card, and you sense that it's funny and it's stupid because you know that love cannot be coerced. I cannot tell my kids, you will love me. They might even repeat it back to me, but it wouldn't be genuine because they're just doing it because they have to. Love, you can't be robots. And if you want the love, the world where love is possible, that means you have to have a world in which free agency is possible. But if you want a world in which free agency is possible, you better be ready for bad stuff. Because that means you have to have a world in which you have the freedom to hate as well as the freedom to love. Now look, again, we say that God has created this kind of world, a world in which love is possible. But that is a very dangerous world. But a loving God, he wouldn't just give you that kind of... Wouldn't a loving God provide... He's not going to throw the knife at you and not tell you how to catch it by the handle or the blade. What God does is he creates a world in which this dangerous proposition of free agency is available to us so we can genuinely love. And then he gives us a set of guidelines so you will not abuse your free agency. So what God does is he gives you this gift and then in the instruction manual on how to use the gift. Many people though will ignore the instruction manual and misuse the gift. I get that, but that's not on God. An unloving God would give you the gift and no instruction manual. A loving God gives you the gift and the instruction manual. Do you see the difference? We have to have a proper understanding of how free agency works and why it's so important. Also, though, what are we calling love? When we use that term love, it's kind of a stupid term, don't you think? Because the culture has co-opted this term. When I use the word love, most of you are thinking of one of these. Right? Isn't this the definition most of us have of love? Now, if you're a parent in this room, you know that there's another aspect of love I haven't listed here. Right? Tough love goes down there. And I can tell you, I have kids who are adults now. My kids are 20, 21, 26, and now 29. That's right, 26, 29. So that's my kids. Just had a birthday for one of them. So, and I can tell you, there were times along the way where my love for them caused me to have to let go of certain things that I knew this was going to be a train wreck a month from now. But rather than step in and rescue, I just said, okay, they're adults, okay? They're not even living here anymore. I have to allow this to happen so they'll learn from their mistake. Tough love is part of love. Would you agree? This is what C.S. Lewis says about love. I think it's so apropos. He says, we want, in fact, as Christians, not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven. You know, the senile benevolence who, as they say, like to see young people enjoying themselves, and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be truly said at the end of the day, a good time was had by all. Okay, that is not God. That's not even your father. That might be your grandfather. I'm looking forward to that, by the way. I can't wait until that's my goal in life, is to tick off my kids by just spoiling their grandkids, right? I can't wait. But this is not what God is. Look at it this way. Go back to our timeline. Okay, so here's your earthly life. You might say that this is your temporal life and this is your eternal life. Another way of saying that this is your life here on earth. This is your life post-earth. Okay, get all that. If you've got parents, you know they are helping you out in this area right here. Make sense? Now, you might say, well, look, as a parent, I'm going to have to allow them to suffer something here because I want something better for them over here. And you see that now because you've been parents, or you've had a chance to see what your parents did for you. You get that. But if there's if this is what life really is, that means you have earthly parents, but you also have a post-earthly parent who has jurisdiction over all of this. And he might allow something that bad to happen to you. Oh, yeah, but I knew that guy. That happened to him, and he died. It never got fixed. Nothing good ever came of that. Well, yeah, stupid, because you're looking for it over here. God is in charge of all of this. He might be trying to achieve something over here. How do you know what he's trying to achieve? As parents, he's trying to achieve something downstream. Or maybe not even with you, with one of your siblings. The point is, God has jurisdiction as a parent over all of that. And by the way, God doesn't care about your comfort. God cares about your character. He's aiming at something that is lasting, because our lives actually are lasting, even though we sometimes deny it. Well, this is the one that used to drive me crazy. Really? You want me to believe that some of the stuff that's happening, houses are being burned down in Northern California. We just suffered two major hurricanes, another one coming on. And we've had earthquakes like crazy all over the continent right now. And you want me to believe that that actually is God doing that, allowing that to develop character? Well, I'll tell you, as an atheist, I believe that these were very important virtues. As a non-believer, I wanted a world in which these characteristics existed. My dad loves the fact he lives in a Christian country, although he's not a Christian. But I want, as an atheist, those things to emerge. Don't you think everyone likes those things as virtues? Oh, really? So if you want God to design a planet in which those virtues emerge, how do you think you're going to get them? You're not robots. You can't just... These are simply responses to events. I don't just snap my fingers and give you courage. You get courage in the face of danger. You have to have a world in which danger exists if you want. You want to be compassionate? Well, I'm going to have to give you something to be compassionate about: suffering. Oh, you want to develop forgiveness? Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to give you some evil then to forgive. Oh, you want to have self-sacrifice? I'm going to have to give you something that's a hardship. Oh, you want to develop charity? I'm going to introduce you to poverty. You can't have those virtues unless you have a world that looks like this. Oh, guess what? That's what the world looks like. This is why I never pray for patience. What kind of an idiot prays for patience? You pray for patience. Let me tell you what's going to happen. You're going to get something that's going to test your patience. You don't want that. This is how Lewis puts it. To ask that God's love should be content with us as we are is to ask that God should cease to be God. Because He is what He is, His love must, in the nature of things, be impeded and repelled by certain stains in our present character. And because He already loves us, He must labor to make us lovable. You don't get these kinds of stains of character out unless He presents you with problems or allows you to be presented with problems. Then we talk about, well, can it draw you? Look, as a non-believer, I would have said, hey, couldn't God just tap me on the shoulder? Say, Jim, come on. Isn't that a better way to get me, just to come and reach out? And, well, really? That was happening for me for years. I worked a surveillance team in Los Angeles for 4 years. I did nothing but listen to radio. But I made sure I turned past all the Christian radio stations that were preaching the Bible. I didn't want to hear anything from this word. I didn't want to hear anything from his preachers. And I didn't want to hear anything from anybody who would come into my life who said they were a Christian. In other words, I ignored the way that God was trying to reach out to me. So if that's what's going to happen, guess what might happen next? If He's not going to reach out, He can just push you. He can pull you or He can push you. Now, when God pushes you, it never feels good. Because it's usually on the back of some disaster in your own personal life. Again, let's go back to Lewis for a second. Let me implore the reader to believe, if only for the moment, that God, who made these deserving people, may really be right when He thinks that their modest prosperity and the happiness of their children are not enough to make them blessed. That all of this must fall from them in the end. There's times when we think we are blessed because we're so self-sufficient. And then your house burns down. And for the first time, you're wondering if it's you. Are you God, really? You think you're God? There's times we don't even pay attention to the existence of God until something slaps us in the face to make us realize that we're not God. That we're not blessed on our own. That we're not the cause of all blessing. Then it comes down to this tug of war, I think, between God's mercy and God's justice. Look, it seems to me that God is a God of both love and justice. And I don't think you can have a loving God unless there is justice. If I was to tell my son, David, I love you more than anyone. I think the world of you. I couldn't love you anymore. And then I stop the car and I see a bank robber run out of the street, just shooting back at the bank. And I stop the bank robber and I say, bank robber, I love you more than I love you. I can never love you anymore. I say the exact same thing to the bank robber that my son knows. You know what? He just says that to anybody. It doesn't mean anything. If you're not just in the way you dispense your mercy is just a statement. It's not real. So all of us understand this relationship between justice and mercy. We don't just give it to anybody. That makes sense? And if there is justice, if God is a just God, then we have to understand the three forms of justice. So I'll put them on the wall for you. These are three forms of justice in our penal system, penal code system. And it's also, I think, be true of any parent and any description of God. The first is what's called retributive justice. And this is about punishing for the past. Are there times as a parent you just do this? Hey, you made me so mad yesterday when you did that. Now you're grounded. What am I really? I'm really mad about yesterday. How many of you done that as a parent? The rest of you are all liars. Then there's another kind of justice I like a little better. It's called utilitarian justice. And that is about punishing for the future. This one is rearview mirror. This one is through your windshield. Because I might say, hey, that thing you did yesterday really irritated me. But that's my bigger concern is if you continue to do that. And if you do that tomorrow and the next day, you do it with an employer 5 years from now, your life is going to be a train wreck. I am punishing you now, not for yesterday. I'm punishing you for tomorrow. I don't want you to do this anymore. That's what that form of justice looks like. You can see how that might just feel like punishment, but it really is the love of a parent looking downfield, right? The last one is what we call restorative justice. And sometimes we just have this in our sentencing guidelines where we'll say, hey, you're going to serve some time in jail, but I also want you to pay back the victim so much to restore what you took. Well, my whole point here is that these three forms of justice are administered by all parents. You do this. I do this. God would certainly do this. And finally, why do we think we know how to explain this anyway? You think you as a human have enough brain power to understand what God has in store, what God's trying to do? If God's working not in the 90 years of your life, but He's working across all eternity? You think you're that smart? Let me show it to you this way. So Epicurus, he says, okay, I got this great dilemma for all these people who believe in God. I'm going to prove to you there can be no God. Here's my complaint. This first part, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. The second part is he willing, able rather, but not willing? Well, then he's malevolent. The first part is a complaint against what we would say is a characteristic of God as Christians we call God's all-powerful omnipotence, right? The second complaint is a complaint about his omnibenevolence, about his all-loving nature. And I can see why this complaint sounds compelling. You know why it sounds compelling? Because Epicurus is intentionally leaving off the third leg of the stool. He knows, I think he knew he was doing it. So this sounds like a dilemma until you add in the third characteristic that you and I accept as theists. And that is that God is all-knowing. That is nowhere to be found in his complaint, is it? But it turns out that this often explains the other two. Let's go back to our timeline. So this is the stuff that we know about. Duh. This is the stuff that God knows about. Do you see the difference? This is why a French Dominican priest once put it this way. If God could concede me his omnipotence for 24 hours, you would see how many changes I would make in the world. But if he gave me his wisdom too, I would leave things as they are. Remember that everything that happens today has some connectivity to what happens tomorrow. That ripple, you don't know what ripples you're causing that affect things down, especially if you're not even aware of where the ripple goes. This butterfly effect, right? That some small thing that happens. But God would know all of that. And he might allow something to happen here because he knows what the domino effect is over here. He knows which way the dominoes fall. And you don't. So look, when it comes down to it and someone says to me, how do I explain any act of evil? Why would there be an all-powerful, all-loving God who would allow that? Well, I know it's going to have to be some set of stars aligning involving these seven factors. And how does that really work? Well, I don't know, because there's going to be some relationship of proportionality to any act of evil. He might have one objective in mind over another. Only in the mind of God would you even know. And you only in the mind of God would know how these things are connected to each other. And then how all of this is used to explain an act of evil. God is the master detective here who has puzzled this back together for the greater good. But I don't know his mind. Does that make sense? But in the end, can you see that there's more than adequate explanation? But then why are we calling this thing evil to begin with? Because you don't like what happened to Jackie? It's evil to you? Or do you think it should be evil to everybody else too? You think it should be evil to everybody else too? You think that that thing is truly evil? I mean, evil in a way that transcends not just you, but any group you're part of? You think that would have been evil if it happened on Klingon to some Klingon child, don't you? If there was a Star Trek universe. Or if it happened to a Romulan child, it would be evil. Well, what? Seriously? You think there's an evil that transcends not only us as a people group, not only us individually, not only us as a nation, not only us as a planet, that even if there's a Star Trek world, this kind of evil will be transcend the entire set, the Federation of Planets? Really? Where does that come from? Back to Lewis. When he was an atheist, he said his argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. So what was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? So it turns out, if we get to a point where we're looking at this universe and we're trying to stay inside the room, and I posit that the best explanation for the stuff in the room is a God who's there with us, you might say, no, it can't be true because there's evil in the world. And that eliminates the possibility there's a good, loving, all-powerful God. Really? Well, here's a problem. If you think this can't be reconciled, I'd ask you, what do you think evil really is? If you think evil is truly transcendent, that it's not just a matter of your personal opinion. And by the way, if it was a matter of your personal opinion, or even the opinion of all of you, you could eliminate all evil tomorrow. You know how you do that? Change your mind. All evil goes away. It doesn't work, huh? Instead, you think there's a transcendent standard of good, a standard of righteousness that is so obvious that any deviation is evil. Well, where are you getting that transcendent standard of good from? It turns out if there is no God, holy, righteous God, as the standard, a transcendent standard of righteousness, evil is simply a matter of opinion. But if you want to trust that this is what's going on, well, that's a cause that's not inside the room. That cause transcends naturalism. We now have stepped outside the room for an answer. Lewis said, of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by simply saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own, a personal opinion. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies, which is a nice British way of saying my personal opinion. Yeah. Now, if there is an objective standard of good outside the room, that might explain why we call things evil inside the room. Because we understand they're violating the objective standard. You can't have the shadow without the sunshine. So we go back to this model we started with. Here it is. Inside or outside the room? How do we explain this? Well, remember, if we discover an intruder, it should change the way we see things. Intruders should, other things that turn death scenes into crime scenes. And of course, it also ought to give us a sense of urgency. So that's why we do these conferences, right? That's why we come to these conferences. I hope we don't come to conferences like this to be entertained by Christian speakers. You come because you sense urgency. You sense urgency in our culture. We need to do something. Now, these are illustrations. Some of these are all illustrations from my book, just so you know. I have a background. My background was in design and architecture before I became a police officer, so that just allows me to illustrate my own books. That's about all you get out of art school. I'm sorry. For those of you who are in art school, time to change your major. Anyway, the point is, did I say that? No, we need more Christians in art school. Don't get me wrong. My wife's already given me the evil eye for saying you should not have artists, and Christian artists are important, right? But the thing is here, we have to look at these eight things and explain these. Can we explain these by going inside the room for an explanation, or is the better explanation outside the room? I do think the better explanation is outside the room. And remember, every time I come into a crime scene, I am able to say something about the nature of the suspect just from looking at the evidence in the crime scene. Some crime scenes make my investigation easier. Look, if you're shot in the head at a 7-Eleven, or do you have 7-Elevens out here? Arco, AMPM, or whatever your fast, you know, your gas station. And there's money missing from the till. He's been executed with one bullet in the back of his head. That's one kind of killer. If the same guy is stabbed 70 times in the groin in his bedroom, different kind of killer. Would you agree? Which of those two killers probably knows my guy intimately? Second one, right? So in one case, I have the entire population of the United States that might be involved as a suspect. In the other one, I just have the people who know him intimately. Only a few of those. Which is going to be an easier case to work? The one in the bedroom. Why? Because I'm looking at the crime scene and I'm asking the question, can I make a decision about what the suspect looks like based on the evidence in the room? Something similar happens here. I've got these eight pieces of evidence in the room. And now I think I can begin to describe my suspect. And by the way, it's probably not going to be Mick Jagger. Okay? Because Mick can't explain the nature of this evidence. The evidence requires a certain kind of suspect. Look, I'm looking for something that's non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material, that is intelligent enough to fine-tune the entire universe for the existence of life, and powerful enough to be able to control the cosmological constants, and is the source of information that can be found in DNA, which helps life begin to begin with, and is the designer behind the design we see in biology. Also, is a conscious mind that has free agency and is designing other beings in its image with conscious minds who have free agency, and is the standard of righteousness by which we judge any moral act and call anything evil. That's not Mick. Agreed? He can't get these things done. Of course, there is a suspect who could explain all of this. Now, what's interesting about these kinds of cases is that all my cases are built cumulatively in a similar way. So here's a guy I took to jail. I think we convicted him in 2014. And he did the crime in 1979. It was a two-hour episode of Dateline. We convicted this guy on the basis of several kinds of evidence. We had some witness observations. That was helpful. We had some behaviors he exhibited. We had some actual forensic evidence. He left his murder weapon at the scene, for crying out loud. And finally, we had some statements he made. So what I'm saying here is that these first two are really about eyewitness statements. This is about how to evaluate reliable eyewitnesses. Different kinds of experts are used in trial for this. This is about behavioral evidence. I'll use a FBI expert on behavior. That's kind of experts we're going to use for this. These are about forensic evidences. So someone from the crime lab is going to come in and talk about different mass spectrometry, all these different things we use on forensic evidence. And here, this is about statements. This is going to be stuff like forensic statement analysis. Here's my point. When you have this much kinds of different types of evidence, with entirely different experts, and all of them on their own say, yeah, the best explanation is him. These guys say it, these guys say it, these guys say it. I probably have the right guy because I've got such variety of evidence. Well, it turns out the same thing is happening in our case, right? We have this suspect and we have 8 pieces of evidence. 2 are entirely cosmological. I'd be interviewing astrophysicists for these kinds of data. The best data here points to God's existence. Here, these are entirely biological. These are going to be biochemists, microbiologists. These folks are also pointing on their own. If all I had was this evidence, it would still point to him. These two are all neuroscientists and philosophers, and these two are all ethicists and philosophers. My point is, very different disciplines. And all of them point to the same suspect? Probably got a good suspect. Now, I'll just tell you that when we did a trial recently with Robert Shapiro of O.J. Simpson fame, he's very good at saying, well, let me tell you, jury, he's got it wrong. I can explain this evidence other ways. I can find experts to explain this 4 different ways. And I got experts that will explain this 4 different ways. And I got 4 here and 3 there and 5 there and 4 here and 3 there. Really? Yeah, don't look at me wrong. There are other ways to explain this by staying inside the room. There is. The problem is none of them work. And none of them agree. So this guy says, oh yeah, I can explain this. And this guy here standing next to me, he's wrong. And this guy, he's wrong. This guy says, oh yeah, well this guy's wrong. And this guy's wrong. And this guy's wrong. And by the way, whatever they're using to explain this, none of those 4 causes will explain this. None of those 4 causes will explain this. Do you see the problem with this explanation? How many suspects do you think I have here? Now there's another way to explain all that evidence. There might just be one common causal suspect that not only explains all the evidence, it actually unifies the evidence in front of the jury. Oh, which is more reasonable? This unlikely array of coincidences that just happen to make him look like he's the guy, or he's the guy. Which is it? Now, I will tell you, they have been working for years to develop a theory of everything that will unify quantum physics with macrophysics, right? Classic macrophysics. And you've seen the movie, A Theory of Everything, right? I'm here to tell you today a discovery. There is a theory of everything. Are you ready? It's called God. God is the theory of everything. And this is what we talk about in God's crime scene. Now, I've got 7 minutes, which is good. I'm ahead of myself a little bit. I wanted to share with you why this became so important to me. As I was examining Scripture, as an atheist, I was building the case for why I was trying to figure out, are these reliable documents? Are the Gospels reliable? And I was building my case the way I would in front of any jury. I've drawn it in cold case Christianity. Here it is. I think we've got an excellent case for the reliability of Scripture. But it is cumulative. And it's robust. I call this death by 1,000 paper cuts. Each one of these might seem like a paper cut, but when you add them all up, it's overwhelming. But my problem was, okay, here's the problem with Scripture though. Even if you can make a case like this, the Scripture includes a story of a guy named Jesus who did stuff that people don't do. They don't walk on water. They don't do miraculous. Miracles don't occur. I was a very committed philosophical naturalist. I thought everything could be explained by staying inside the room. So I rejected this. I rejected anything supernatural in the Gospels. They could be reliable, but not about this stuff. This stuff has to be added late. It has to be a distortion. It can't be true. Well, then I stopped and I looked at whether or not I could actually explain the stuff in the room by staying in the room. And I realized I can't. I couldn't explain it by staying in the room. I'm looking for something that I can define, an all-powerful, non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material first cause. In other words, if this is the stuff we label as nature, I'm looking for something that's not that. I'm looking for something, I don't know, that's extra-natural. I mean, it's like supra-natural. It's supernatural. And if there is a God, a personal being who could supernaturally blink everything into the universe into existence from nothing, I'm guessing he could do this stuff. And that changed everything. Because then I realized that all the stuff that was in Scripture about Jesus was now available to me because I already accepted the extra natural. The only question is that extra natural first cause personal or impersonal? And if I know that it's a personal cause, why couldn't he do all that? It just changed the way I looked at Scripture. That makes sense? And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of my session. I will see you tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock.